Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. Insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
Have you heard? The Burt Cohen Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. Hi, this is Burt Cohen. Recent shows include the status of freedom of the press under President Obama. Is it time to make the Federal Reserve a public utility? Is the dream of Israel over? How is the Tea Party like the Confederacy? The true history of the National Rifle Association, and how is 2014 like 1914? The Burt Cohen Show, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. There's really nothing like it.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter Bregan. And I'm home today with the flu. Gosh, I had a fever last night, the first time in 15 years, I think. But I'm recovering already, but I didn't get out of the office where I have my Skype equipment and my good microphone, my baffling, you know, sort of a little mini, it's anyhow a much better place to speak to you from. So if the quality of my voice is a little off, it's a combination of that I'm not in my little mini studio, and my voice is a little hoarse. I didn't want to substitute today. For one, I have a lovely guest, and I think it probably would have made him nervous if I'd called him 5 minutes ago and said, "Patrick, I'm not going to be on today." You there, Patrick?
I am. I'm here. How are you?
Good. I'm glad you got through. He's calling from Canada.
Yes, yes.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to be sure to be on today is I wanted to remind you all that on February 28th, not this Friday, but the following Friday, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, that's me and Ginger and our marvelous advisory council of, 60 or 70 outstanding folks, we are co-conferencing in Florida at Tampa with the Adlerian Society of Florida. It looks like this concept we have now of co-conferencing, not that we merely co-sponsor, but that we actually have these two organizations bringing their resources together, our center and the Adlerians. And it's turning out to be very good. They're telling me that they're going to exceed their usual audiences by a lot, and theirs are usually in the several, many hundreds. On Friday the 28th, I'm going to start out the day talking about psychotherapy without medication for the most challenging clients. And then just as if you were at one of our conferences that's not co-conference, I'll spend the day emceeing the rest of the group, interacting with the people, introducing them. Then on the following day, on Saturday, I'll have a breakout workshop as well. There's a lot of really interesting people going to be at this conference. Kevin Miller, some of you may know. Kevin is the filmmaker of Generation RX. But then some other people that you may not know about. Tim Evans is a marvelous psychologist. Jerry Carter, another psychologist. They are running the conference. They'll be talking about couples and sex therapy. They'll be talking about lifestyle assessment. We're going to have the founders of an Adlerian elementary school, a school where nobody's called ADHD and nobody's given drugs. I mean, that's worth of coming on down and listening to what goes on. Judge Lynn Tepper is a marvelous judge in what's called the dependency court in Florida. She helps families and does it in a really caring, empathic way. She supports the most down-and-out folks, and she does not go the psychiatric route. She really tries to help families, including children, without psychiatric diagnoses and drugs. Lisbeth Reese Cooper is going to be there. Lisbeth runs and founded a pair of rehabilitation psychiatric treatment centers in Georgia, and she is actually in North Carolina. And she is just doing amazing things. And also there is going to be the Mother Bear Community Action Network, which is our answer, the good folks' answer to NAMI. Ginger and I support Mother Bear Community Action Network. And it's just going to be full of better alternatives as well as some good solid critique. So I'm looking forward to seeing you there. There'll be 19.5 hours of professional continuing education credits, including for LMHC and LMFT and NBCC and other professions. Really good conference. The Thursday is going to be mostly Adlerian workshops. You might find it really interesting. Adlerian psychology is all about social relationships. Alfred Adler had a profound influence in my thinking early on in my career. I read many, many of his books. And then the Friday, I'll be talking on the 28th of February, and then on March 1, the breakout, and another really great day. So come along. Now, because I'm at home with my dry voice, I'm on a hard line. I can't Skype, so I'm... the way we run things at a PRN is very professional, and when we're doing our radio shows, we have the ability to Skype and to text message, to instant message, IM back and forth with our engineer, who today is Melissa. And, well, I can't IM because I'm out in the country here, and the Skype connection just isn't good enough. By the way, I'm looking out over snow and the Cuyahoga Lake, and it's kind of a dreary day, but it's always beautiful here above the lake. So if anything comes up that we're having any kind of problems, I expect Melissa to just sort of break in and say, well, here's what's happening. But that would be rare indeed. I'm still savoring the victory that's now up on our website of the malpractice victory in Chicago, where I was a psychiatric expert in a case of an autistic youngster who was put on Risperdal and then on Zyprexa and developed a horrendous case of tardive akathisia, which is like being tortured from the inside out, so you have to move. It's just so painful you keep moving all the time. It's a terrible, terrible drug-induced disorder, and we got $1.5 million victory, and I just feel that juries and the public in general now are just much more aware of what's going on. Well, that's a longer intro than usual. my guest is Patrick Allen. Patrick is a very interesting man. He's a student, an academician in the field of bioethics, medical ethics, psychology, religious studies, philosophy of health and happiness, philosophy of psychiatry, healthcare law. He couldn't have a better platform than my show and my wonderful audience. I mean, this is just right. In addition, he lives in Canada. He studies in Great Britain, and he knows about the U.S., so he's going to be able to give us an overview, which I've been working more and more on, reaching out not just to co-conference like I am the weekend after this coming one, but I've been reaching out to Great Britain. I'm a member of the CPN there, the Critical Psychiatry Network. I got over 200 psychiatrists there. We talked about that last week with Philip Thomas from Great Britain, psychiatrist. So Patrick spans three nations, really, and probably knows something about Europe as well. He has got a master's degree from the University of Manchester, that's in Great Britain, for social ethics and policy. From the School of Law, the combined degree, it looks like. Now, listen to this. This is and then we'll invite Patrick on. This is the title of his master's thesis. Quote, "An ethical analysis of the serotonin hypothesis and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors for the treatment of depression." Patrick, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter. It's a true pleasure. Like you, we got a snowstorm last night in eastern Canada, so we're just digging out, and we're having another one tonight. So just getting ready for that. But no, it's a true pleasure to be on your show. Thanks so much.
Fill the folks out on anything more about yourself, and we've got a lot of different things to talk about. Including one of your main interests, anxiety and depression.
Sure.
And how that relates to philosophy, psychology, and biology. But you want to say anything more about yourself before we go there?
Yeah, I mean, my background is obviously very varied. I started an undergraduate in Prince Edward Island here at the University of Prince Edward Island in psychology. And after a couple of years of studying psychology, I decided that it wasn't for me. Specifically to be a psychologist or to go down that track. So late in the degree, I switched to religious studies with the focus on ethics. We don't have a law school here, so that was, I was more interested in what was right and wrong in studying those kinds of things. So I graduated from the undergraduate here with a focus in religious studies and ethics, and then moved on into like you say, the Center for Social Ethics and Policy at the University of Manchester in the UK in a master's program. And what I was really interested in doing is really understanding, basically medical ethics and how things work in terms of what patient rights are, how pharmaceutical industries interact with governments, those kinds of things. And it wasn't part of the curriculum to study, SSRI antidepressants. But what happened was I started to really delve into the relationship between psychopharmacology and people and psychiatry and psychology. And I realized that there was something really interesting there to study. Because for a very long time I'd felt that ideas in psychology, or abnormal psychology, if you will, were very, ambiguous. So I found that the idea...
You can use strong language on this show. This is a place you don't have to inhibit yourself.
I thought that, there were problems with the idea that, somebody's brain is got chemical problems and a drug will correct it. So I started looking into it in terms of, is this right or wrong? Should we be feeding people pills, And then I started studying, and that's where that, master's thesis came from. And then after that, I decided, I really want to study philosophy because I think the real problems that need to be mended have to do with how we conceptualize things like anxiety, depression, or any of the other labels we assign to mental states, right? So here I am, you know, and speaking with you.
Well, tell us some more about you. I mean, you chose a very chemical title. Was that in part to debunk it?
Well, what I found in the thesis, the first way I started looking at it was where this all came from. You know, where did the idea that, you know, serotonin had a linkage to something called depression, you know, where did this all come from? And when you look back at it, a lot of the science was serendipitous, or it happened by accident, right? But the truth is I'm going to use another big word, but I'll explain it. It's all based on backwards or ex juventibus reasoning. So, for instance, if you give somebody a pill and they get better, there's this idea that because they took the pill, they must have the diagnosis that you presumed, right?
Yeah, it's like people who are compelled to take cocaine obviously have cocaine deficiencies.
Yeah.
And they're a lot more driven to take the cocaine than people are driven to take Prozac, so they must have huge deficiency.
Yeah, and that's exactly what that's exactly it. They're trying to figure out the cause of a disorder or disease based on what they're trying to use to fix it, right? And we don't see that in a lot of other cases in medicine. It's a different kind of way of reasoning about cause and effect, or, you know, the scientific process behind if drugs do work or not, right? But even then, I started looking at things, you know, other little hints started popping up about SSRIs, for instance, you know, this idea that it takes 6 to 8 weeks for them to work, you know, this down-regulation period that they cite all the time. And what happened was I realized that a lot of people who are, you know, depressed or have anxiety problems are usually, or in some cases, better in 6 to 8 weeks regardless if they take drugs. So what I realized is that the cause and effect wasn't really that, you know, powerful between the use of these drugs.
Well, you know, there's also another thing about that, which is that since most of the studies only last 6 to 8 weeks and don't really show much effect, we now know actually
sure, yeah.
They don't show any effect if you look at all the studies done for FDA approval.
Yeah.
You could cherry pick them to show
oh,
any
sure,
effect.
Yeah.
So since they don't work at 4 to 6 weeks, they tell you got to take it for at least 4 to 6 weeks.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that was, I read a book by a gentleman from, I believe he works at Harvard, Dr. Irving Kirsch, and that
sure.
was one of the main texts that got me inspired to look down look into this. And so, you know, what I found was an ethical argument, because if you're going to give somebody medication, you know, what I did find was that they're giving every reason for you to be scared of this medication, or every side effect that had ever been cited. So they'll tell you, you know, your ears will ring, you'll be nauseated, you might have this, you might have that, and that's very well documented. But what they don't disclose is that serotonin is likely not associated with the condition that they think you have,
right,
or why the drug works, right? So I found this really interesting that they would tell you every adverse effect or side effect, but they wouldn't tell you, you know, that the science behind these drugs is wobbly, you know. And then you start looking at the statistics for usage of these drugs, and then you become absolutely baffled. It becomes overwhelming, really. You know, 300 and some million prescriptions written, I think, in 2010, just in the United States. So, you know, we live in a world where a lot of the advertising is believed, you know, at face value, and I think that's part of the problem also, right?
Well, yeah, and unfortunately your local GP or your local internist or OBGYN is as taken in as anybody else.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dispense, you come in and say you're tired, you're going to, and especially if you're a woman, you're going to get an SSRI.
Sure. And in fact, it's interesting you made that point, because I have been in pharmacies and just sort of brought it up with the local pharmacist, you know, look, I'm researching this, and this is what, you know, my impression is about these drugs. Do you know anything about this? And really what they're trained to say is, nope, here's the monograph, you know, and this is what I know about it. And granted, that's fine, but again, like you say, there's cherry picking behind the science, there's, you know, all kinds of things.
What pharmacies? Because you're in Canada, and England more than the U.S., right? So what pharmacy, what country are you talking about?
I'm talking about Canada. I mean, mm-hmm. I live in Canada. That's I live in actually a place called Prince Edward Island, if you're familiar. I'm not too far away from you guys. But I mean, the truth is, it's the same. It's the same drugs here
right.
as they prescribe in the U.S.
So they pretty much go along with our FDA when they approve drugs.
Well, yes. I mean, the FDA will approve it. Health Canada, which would be the FDA of Canada, will look at these drugs, look at the science behind them, and do the same kind of vetting process, right? And then we have provinces. So we have, you know, different areas that will decide which drugs are covered on formularies and things like that. But as far as safety and efficacy, that's decided at a federal level. And I think, yes, the FDA does have some influence on that, right?
Oh, I think they really follow suit to a great extent. When we came out with all the warnings on the SSRIs, which I'm pleased to say is partly the result of my work, they were just adopted in Canada. And sometimes a little stronger. For example, the SSRI warnings in Canada actually come out and say that these drugs are can cause not just suicidality, but aggressivity. They specifically mention harm to self and others.
Yes, and I've seen that also, yeah.
That far.
Yeah. I think that's just wonderful. I think the real issue with any drug is that people should know what they're getting into, right? And there has to be a better, you know, level of informed consent, and that's really what I found in that research. Was that people aren't getting the full story, right? And they're taking these drugs hoping to recover from depression or some kind of anxiety or whatever, you know, they were prescribed for, which is another issue because the net is becoming bigger and bigger, right? So I mean, what I did find was that the informed consent issue was the thing that was central to this, is that you need to tell people exactly what they're getting into with the drug in terms of how it works, why it works, you know, what's the science behind it. If you don't know, tell people you don't know, you know. At least give them, you know, the choice, if you will, right? Don't tell people that it fixes a serotonin imbalance and that's the reason that you have depression or panic attacks or something, right?
Now, what has happened with you in the academic community? Your master's degree and now you're going for your PhD, isn't that right,
sure.
Patrick? And that's in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
What do you get in the way of resistance? In this country, you'd probably get thrown out of a PhD program for being critical of psychiatric drugs.
Well, you know, I think that's probably one of the reasons I'm really getting involved in this, and especially with philosophy, because, I mean, philosophy, you get to say what you want as long as you can defend it kind of thing, right? So it's less political, if you will. I mean, there's always going to be politics in terms of, you know, jobs at universities or any kind of organization. But for me, when I started studying ethics, I wanted to be sort of true to the ethics of the thing, you know. So it's sort of a journey for me to learn about this and become even an independent researcher and write books to help people understand these issues, right? So in terms of academia, I haven't actually had any resistance. In fact, I presented a poster on this at a bioethics conference in June of last year in Banff in the Rocky Mountains, and it was well received. In fact, some psychiatrists at the conference approached me and said, you know, this is really great. I'm glad you're showing me this, you know. So I haven't had a lot of...
That's quite astonishing. I think times are changing. I think they are.
Well, I think people are becoming aware that complex life issues, you know, are not going to be solved with drugs or a panacea or anything like that. There's no simple solution for, you know, different life problems, is there? You know, we've become a culture where we want a quick fix, and I think that is why we have gotten here, right? But I think that it's reversing, like you say, and I think we're getting back into the dialogue of what are the best ways to treat, you know, mental illnesses or to look about these things.
So have you challenged the concept of mental illness? We don't say those words here without putting them in parentheses.
Yeah, and I meant it like that. I think the problem with that term is actually that we can't define it, right? And I agree with you on that. It just seems to be the word that they use.
Yep.
you know, and I think that a lot of the times when I'm writing, I'll use the word mental states instead, to sort of just be more neutral, right? But I do agree.
Mental, sorry? Spiritual, psychological states.
Right.
Psycho-spiritual.
It's such a varied, it's such a difficult thing to pin down, right? In fact, some of the people that I work with write papers about people that commit really atrocious crimes and say, well, that's, you know, they did this awful thing, but again, we don't think this is the result of a quote-unquote mental illness, you know. We think this is a result of, you know, political ideology or whatever was the particular cause of, you know, whatever action the person took, you know. So I think there is actually becoming, like you say, a shift away from, I guess, the biological or medicalization of so-called mental illness, right?
Well, I think there is a shift away outside of psychiatry.
Sure.
But psychiatry will hunker down in the face of this criticism and just shout louder and louder, biology, biology.
Yeah.
Because that's how they make their living. It's how they have their authority, their power.
Yeah, I try to be kind of apologetic. I'm not apologetic to the biological model. I mean, philosophically, it's hard to say that these things aren't biological, because if you think about it, everything's biological, right?
That's their argument.
I know.
And rooting for the Yankees is biologic. Preferring Canada to the U.S. is biologic.
Yeah, because, I mean, what they were trying to do is derive causation. Yeah, they're trying. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, obviously, if you chop our heads off, we're not there. If you take our brains away, we're not there.
Yeah, it's the old mind-body debate, right?
I think there's a difference here. I think that it's a real error to say that everything is biologic because everything requires a brain. If you're going to say that, then what you have to say is that all of life emanates from biology, but that has, if you believe that, I'm not sure I believe that,
mm-hmm.
but if you say that, then you have to say, but there's no defects in biology,
right,
that account for why somebody becomes a Catholic or a Presbyterian, or why somebody is a angry person or is not,
sure,
or why somebody is loving or is not.
Right.
We all have basically the same brain that we're working with.
Yeah, nobody is born a murderer or, you know, to commit hate crimes or something. A little baby doesn't, there's many things that happen in their life that probably lead them to that, right? It's like, again.
Yes, and often, by the way, ironically, often biological compromises of the brain, because behind a great deal of violence is alcohol, the illegal drugs like cocaine,
sure,
and the psychiatric drugs have been
really linked
closely to violence.
Yeah, because you're altering biology. Yeah. You're altering biology, and that's also, I'm a firm believer in that also, you know. There's been a linkage between illicit and psychiatric drugs and violence, like you say. That's quite, quite profound, really. And so, yeah. But no, I mean, with the biology thing, I do agree that that's too lopsided. You can't say everything's biology and just be done with it and say that, you know, your emotions or your life or you can be, you know, cured with a pill, because one of the other problems is we don't know when you're normal. we don't know what's happy and what's not happy. We don't know where the middle ground is, right? How do you know if you're better, right? So,
and there's a serious question, of course, whether happiness is the goal.
Well, that's exactly
it. Living is the goal. Maybe, any number of things. Maybe serving God, serving what's good, serving purposes is the goal.
Yeah, it's almost a question of personal growth, isn't it? Right? So, yeah, so again, my research now really has to do with the ones that they say are the most reported issues, which are, you know, depression and anxiety disorders, and I'm really absolutely involved in researching anxiety, because I don't feel that it needs to be medicalized at all. I feel anxiety is a completely different thing. It's a fear response. I think it's evolutionary. I think that it happens at a place sometimes, and there's better ways of dealing with it than with drugs. And that's just my belief. you know, and I think that there, again, there's too many people believing that they need drugs for these particular conditions, and that's the answer to their problem and this and that, you know.
Yeah. Listen, we're getting near the half hour. I can't, I am back and forth with my engineer, Melissa, but we can start moving toward having some music. When we come back, let's try to delve into anxiety, existential anxiety, fear. What are these things about? Let's try to take a good look at it when we come back. And I'm back. This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. My guest is Patrick Allen. He lives in Canada, studies in Great Britain. He's an ethicist and philosopher who's interested in all the kinds of issues we're interested in on this show. If you missed the beginning, I'm at home with the flu. And so there's two things that might make this show sound a little different in quality. One, my voice is dry. And two, I'm not in my cozy little studio down in my office where I have a high-tech mic and Skyping equipment and, you know, can I think probably the quality of sound is better. Patrick has got a broad range of interests, and one of the things that I think would be good to talk about would be, you know, what is anxiety? What in the world is it about? Where do you want to start?
Yeah, you know, there's been many views about what anxiety is, the nature of it, pretty much back to, you know, the Greeks and Romans.
Sure.
You know, if you look back at Hippocrates and ancient physicians, they kind of talked about it, but they called it melancholia. A little bit of interference here. I don't know if you guys are hearing it. Sorry.
No, I'm not hearing anything.
Okay. Anyway, back in the in ancient times, they talked about something called melancholia, which was kind of an all-encompassing term, which you know, involved, you know, some kind of biological measure causing, you know, some kind of anxiety or what we call depression or anxiety now. Right.
So even then, Hippocrates was actually talking about biology.
Yeah, he took what we would call a biological view in this.
And he's a physician.
Yeah.
You know, what else are we going to do if we're physicians? We got to have superior knowledge, so it's got to be medical.
Well, sure. Yeah, you know, but he was pretty much the first to take this biological view, according to a historical account, and frame it in terms of humors. They had a view that there were, you know, four basic humors, and if one of these particular humors was out of balance, you would manifest some kind of illness. And in terms of melancholia, or what we think anxiety was, you know, talked about back then, it was black bile. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Yeah.
And that if it was unbalanced, you would have anxiety. Now, Galen, a couple hundred years later, talked about it in terms of yellow bile. So we see a progression and a belief system being created in classical Greece about these particular issues.
Galen, again, is a physician. So, I mean, this is the key here.
That's correct. Galen was a Roman physician. He lived about 600 years after Hippocrates. And he sort of, you know, guided this medical view or biological view right through, you know, until basically the Enlightenment. You know, there was a long period where it wasn't tested, right?
Well, tell me, were philosophers, though, like Aristotle and Plato, the familiar names, were they talking about anxiety?
Sure, yeah, they were. And there was a lot, you know, but remember, in ancient Greece, there was, like even now, there was a delineation between what was thought to be, you know, courage or anxiety as a disorder. So, I mean, they tried to put a line in where people should have fear because they're faced with a certain scenario where it's logical to have fear, right? And anxiety where people were not in a situation where somebody else would presume that they should be fearful, right? So that's where we get our broader definition of anxiety or an anxiety disorder, is that when you don't have any particular stressor, that's present, it's anxiety because you're projecting into the future about something that may or may not happen. Right?
I think there's a really important clinical distinction that I make, which is that anxiety is actually a feeling of helplessness. And fear does not have to be a feeling of helplessness at all.
No, it
doesn't. You know, a person who's driving along the road here up in upstate New York and sees a deer will certainly have fear, but then they can remember, okay, I'm not supposed to swerve. I'm supposed to slow down a little bit. If I hit the deer, it's too bad for the deer, but it's better than my hitting a tree. And people can go through that, and that's fear, and their heart's pounding. But anxiety would be, oh, my God, there's a deer. You freeze on the wheel, and you can't do anything, or you swerve your car. So I think that whether or not you're giving up cognitive function and whether or not you are becoming helpless is the real distinction for me between fear and anxiety, and can help people to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically my view also. What I see with fear is that, you know, and in the strictest definition is that, for instance, you know, if you look at humans 50,000 years ago, you know, a tiger would jump out of the bushes, and then you would have a good reason to be fearful, and your anxiety or your fight or flight response would be activated in, you know, in survival mode, right? Whereas anxiety now, it's often people are, you know, worried about future events or they're projecting into the future and causing these problems internally. You know, one of the good examples or one of the examples I'm reading about a lot now is this new cyberchondria idea where people are, you know, going on medical websites and with symptoms, you know, like I have a headache, and all of a sudden they, you know, they believe for whatever reason that they have a brain tumor or something, right? And it gets blown way out of proportion. They have a panic attack and end up in the emergency room or something, right? So, you know, anxiety and fear are definitely quite, in my view anyway, are quite linked. But I see anxiety as more like, you know, a projection into the future of something that may or may not happen, right? Whereas, you know, fear is just your basic, you know, response to something.
Well, so, you know, I think that's to some extent true, but you could project fear into the future, too. I think the key is that anxiety is learned in childhood as a form of helplessness. It paralyzes, it demoralizes, it stops from thinking. It has this overwhelming quality, whereas fear can actually heighten your cognition, heighten your ability to think quickly, can rouse you out of being tired or sleepy and get you functioning better. But I think a whole key to what we might substitute the concept of so-called mental illness for is whether or not your responses are enabling you to handle life better or whether they have the quality of making you feel more and more helpless. I think that is such a key.
Sure. I actually agree with you on the fear being projected in the future, too. I agree with that. So I didn't, you know, the delineation is very, very difficult to define. But I do like the helplessness idea, because if you think about the idea of melancholia or where all this came from, the idea of depression or learned helplessness or any of these things were all sort of blanket termed all in one, you know, in the beginning. And it was only, you know, I think was it the 70s or 1980 when the DSM started to come out that they started, you know, identifying specific anxiety disorders. I think even earlier than that, they called it neurasthenia or something like that. And then many, you know, a decade or two later, they started, you know, doing, you know, panic disorder, agoraphobia, and all these different
very
words.
Much under, as you know well, the influence of the drug companies.
Now,
sure,
panic
disorder was created by the Upjohn Company.
Sure,
in order to find a new way of marketing Xanax.
Sure.
So they actually got some docs to develop an idea of panic disorder, which is nothing more than having a few anxiety attacks. I mean, we had the concept already of anxiety attacks or acute anxiety, and panic disorder was just a codification of you're having some anxiety attacks. When I was, this will amuse you, when I was going through a drug company inside the drug companies for a product liability case. The drug company was being sued, and I was a medical expert. I came upon a communication from Upjohn to the FDA complaining that another company was trying to market a drug for panic disorder when panic disorder belonged to the Upjohn company.
Oh, that's interesting. You usually hear about drugs that are proprietary, not diseases, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it really goes together.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I started reading was things about, like, Milltown and the advent of drugs to treat anxiety, right?
Yeah, and that became the age of anxiety.
Yeah.
Entirely due to the pushing of the benzos, which came out ahead of the SSRI antidepressants. You actually switch from an age of anxiety to an age of depression.
That's exactly what, one of the things I wanted to say was that the reason I started off talking about ancient Greece and their idea of it back then is that it almost has come full circle, because we're back to, you know, if you go to a psychiatrist or something and you tell them you have anxiety, the drug indicated for anxiety is an SSRI antidepressant. It's not an anti-anxiolytic, it's an antidepressant, right? So we're again grouping anxiety and depression into the same treatment regimen under that biological model, right?
Yeah, which makes no sense, especially since these drugs all cause depression and anxiety, which is another horrific tragedy.
It's strange, yes. This is why it's a philosopher's dream, really, because there's so many inconsistencies in logic. It just becomes.
Do you think that psychiatry, they really have, my colleagues really have a logic defect, that the, more than other groups of self-interested groups, that psychiatrists actually have difficulty thinking logically about what they're doing?
I don't know if I can make a generalization about
it. I've never asked that question before.
No. But is there a logical defect in treating mental disorders with drugs? Is, you know, the way I see it, right? I think in a lot of cases there's a problem with it. I think there's a problem with psychiatric nosology for sure, meaning classifications, taxonomy, or whatnot. And that's actually quite interesting, because my colleagues, some of the people I study with, you know, their biggest problem with psychiatry is also nosology, so things like the DSM, you know, and where it all came from. Because, again, it's kind of arbitrary to label somebody something to give them a drug if you don't know exactly what's going on with the person, right? So, you know, the quick answer to your question is I think there are some logical inconsistencies with the way that it works. I think that, you know, the way that psychiatry works now, unfortunately, I mean, in Canada, for instance, if you see a psychiatrist in a lot of cases, you don't get a lot of time to talk to that person. So he doesn't really or she doesn't really know who you are, right? And often you see a GP and they'll write a script for an SSRI or something. They won't get to know you before they actually send you away with the script, right? I think there's this quick overprescription presumption that this is a correct treatment for a disorder that they believe in. You know, they believe in these constructs that have been made, you know, in psychiatry and that can come from books like the DSM, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Would you like to talk some about healthcare in Canada and Great Britain in comparison to the U.S. I mean, it's such a big issue for here.
Of course, sure.
We keep hearing that from the propaganda sources about how great it is.
Canadian healthcare is socialized, right? So it's a little bit, well, it's a lot different than the United States. As far as I know, I don't study Britain per se specifically, but they're also under a form of socialized healthcare. Obviously, most every system has its ups and downs. You know, the issue with Canada is that it's extremely costly. It's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we pay a lot of tax for healthcare, so we need to make sure that it's efficient, that it's functioning properly to serve Canadians. Correct. So, you know, it differs from the United States, where my understanding of your system is that, you know, it's more of a, how would I put it? What's a good word for it? Well, it's more patient-centered, right? It's not, I'm looking for the word. If you have good money, you can have great health care. here it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, but we're moving into a two-tiered healthcare system here, and a prime example is things
by
like...
By the way, I think people in this country who are poor have for decades gotten good healthcare if they want to pursue it. They
sure.
get Medicaid. They get many often special opportunities for transportation and other things. I mean, the poor in this country, I'll bet anything, are getting better health care, at least up until recently. I don't know what's going to happen now. I think it's just going to get worse and worse. But
sure,
I think it's a myth to say it's just a money issue, because the fact that we have such a high standard of health care affects the poor as well, who can go to the same emergency rooms I go to.
Sure.
And whether or not they have health coverage, they have to be treated at the emergency room. There's many clinics, medical clinics, and there's most doctors still take Medicaid.
Sure. I can't speak to the U.S. per se. I mean, I know what we get up here is some media about Obamacare and different things like that. Largely, the Canadian attitude towards health care is that it's expensive. And what often happens, and I'll give you a case that may be of public interest, but, you know, things like cancer medications, right? The provinces of Canada decide what drugs, you know, are going to be covered under their formulary, so drugs that you wouldn't have to pay for, right? So we don't need health insurance to pay for these drugs. It comes with being a Canadian and paying tax in a certain province, right? So, you know, I'm actually dealing with an issue in my family where a family member has been diagnosed with a form of cancer, and the treatment exists, except it's not covered under our provincial formulary. So he's on the hook for, you know, $35,000, $40,000 to access this treatment, which is considered a first-line treatment just about everywhere else in the world.
Now, is that a drug?
Yeah, it's a drug. It's a drug that...
$35,000, $40,000, and the government won't cover it.
No. So, but ironically, actually, it's an issue that I'm dealing with right now, because other provinces do cover this drug. You know, the European Union covers this drug as a first-line treatment, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's actually an issue in my province. So the same as one state would cover something, the next state wouldn't. You know?
Well, can you go next door then?
There are stipulations on how long you have to live there and, you know, those kinds of things. So you'd have to uproot your family. It's actually quite funny, because the next province over does cover this drug, and on a clear day we can look through the harbor in my city and see the next province. So, you know, line of sight will save you $40,000.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of bizarre, right, that in Canada we're supposed to have a socialized healthcare system that everybody gets the same quality of care kind of thing, but what's happening is that, you know, it's really not the case, right? People are waiting really long for MRIs, things like that. In my province, for instance, there's been problems with mental health funding. There's been problems with beds for seniors in retirement homes. There's been problems with, like, eight-hour-long emergency room waits, which isn't just exclusive to my province. But there's just been this it's been a management issue, largely. In Canada, if you get really sick, if you're an emergency patient, truly, a car accident victim or something, you're going to get great care right away. It's the diseases like cancer or ongoing chronic illness that you need treatment for that are going to be a problem in terms of treatment, because, like I said, my family member, it took him, I don't know, 2 or 3 months to get diagnosed. And then once he got diagnosed, he found out, you know, you're going to have to pay out of pocket for this particular drug, and that's just the way it is, you know.
Yeah.
So, again, we have a... We're not supposed to have this two-tiered system here, but that's just the case, you know. So maybe that gives you a little bit more insight on how some things work in Canada. Now, overall, it's good health care. It's just not, there are certain things that are lacking, right?
Well, I think one thing that people do not realize is that throughout the world, it is American medicine which is leading the way and is the cutting edge. So
sure.
Just like, and this is not good, but just like Canada relies on the FDA, our FDA, or, and just like the world relies on the DSM-4, which is, you know, these two not-so-good things, they also rely on the U.S. for surgical breakthroughs, medical breakthroughs. you know, for the understanding and research and illness. And
sure.
as we become like others, as we become more of a socialized medicine state, funds will dry up for research and the provision of health care under these cumbersome bureaucracies will go up. So what's going to happen around the whole world is that as we decline in medicine, so will the rest of the world, because it's our system with all of its problems and faults that is nonetheless the most creative and generative. And when, as that goes, the rest of the world's going to feel it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that point in terms of, you know, most of the major breakthroughs in drugs are typically American labs that I'm aware of. You know, in most of the major drug companies, I think GSK is British, correct? But
mm-hmm.
a lot of the major ones are definitely American companies.
Well, they're moving more and more to Europe for tax purposes because we tax so heavily here. But they're relying on U.S. know-how to a
sure.
great extent.
Yeah, it's actually quite an interesting contrast to look at a system like Canada's in comparison to the U.S. because, you know, it's... I remember years ago when I was down in Connecticut fishing with some friends that the first question they asked me was, so how's your health care work up there? You know, it was just blunt. You know, I want to know how health care works in your country.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was such a point of public interest that, you know, they just couldn't understand that, you know, everything was free and we didn't have to worry about insurance. And, you know, there were differences that just seemed alien to them. And, you know, I think that there's great things to be had from both systems. I just think
everything's free if you can get it. If it's not, it's very expensive.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I found with this particular case with the cancer drug that I'm talking about is that, you know, what's a fair price for a life-saving drug? That's a deep philosophical question, right? But what I'm finding is that, you know, I'm doing a side research project in this just to see what's actually happening here. And what drug companies are doing is realizing that, you know, not as many people can have cancer, for instance, or get cancer as have depression, for instance, right? So we can sell all kinds of depression drugs, so the price comes down. We sell it in you know, in bulk kind of thing. But with cancer medications and those, they're not super profitable, so we need to, you know, charge as much as we can, the market can bear, basically, to recoup, you know, or make money.
This is sort of a side issue, but I think it's very important. Do you see a tendency of the drug companies to be backing off from psychiatric drugs now because of all the lawsuits and the...
Yeah, that's been in the media. I mean, it comes off the heels of the Paxil suit
mm-hmm.
and other lawsuits that have been in the media recently. I've actually read an article recently that said that, yes, that was the case. They're abandoning things like antidepressant research and whatnot. But then again, I hear other things about, if you can believe it, deep brain stimulation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems to be that one thing, sort of the fire goes out and the next thing comes along. But they're just, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just marketing.
Yeah, it's just another idea. You know, it's exactly it. It's marketing. And it's funny because we get a lot of the U.S. marketing advertisements up in Canada, and one of the drugs that I've seen a lot of advertising for is this Abilify drug.
Is that a monster drug?
Well, I wanted to bring it up in our conversation eventually because it's the number one selling drug in the United States, right?
You know, I don't know the latest data. If it is, it would be... number one in terms of revenue, not
sure.
numbers of people, because it's a very expensive drug. And they've been near the top, a few of these, Seroquel, a few of these so-called atypical drugs, which is bizarre since they're supposed to be for psychosis.
Well, it's really interesting in a philosophical perspective because the first reason is what you just said. There's not that many people with psychosis that it should be the number one revenue-generating drug in a country. At least I don't think that should be the case, correct?
Yep.
And then the second thing that concerns me is the reason why they're actually prescribing it in the first place, or why that they would report such a profit. And what you find when you look into this is that they're using it almost off-label, right?
Oh, off-label,
they got approval.
A lot, tons. Yeah.
Sorry?
Not almost. I mean, did you say almost?
Well, yes, they're probably doing that too, but the thing that I notice is that they're using it as an adjunct therapy for depression.
Oh, well, that's been approved.
That's right.
I mean, if you don't get numb from your antidepressants, you're sure as hell going to get numb when you take a lobotomizing antipsychotic drug that makes it, your frontal lobe function go down the tubes.
Exactly. So the thing that really, all of a sudden, what struck me when I saw these commercials is that what really they're saying is if the drug we sold you in the first case doesn't work, which if you study these drugs enough, you know, we'll know that they probably won't, add another one of our drugs to potentiate it. It's strange, you know, it's a strange market.
Yeah. But listen, we are going toward the end. I've been talking with Patrick Allen. Patrick gives hope for the future. I think we're seeing more and more people in varied fields around the world are really getting more and more critical of the psychiatric ideology. Patrick, thank you for being on the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Peter.
See you folks in Florida.